Thank you, Danny, for inviting me to say something. I should mention that I'm probably a little bit nervous. I did used to be connected with Narcisse, still am, and usually my pulpit moments were kind of limited to Hebrew scripture reading, so I feel greatly honored to be here to talk to you, to be able to give the sermon today. I hope in the next few minutes, probably about 20, 30 minutes that I have with you this morning, to build a little on Liz Kopp's talk last week. Those of you who were here remember that she spoke about the moments where she was welcomed into Baptist Church by Bob and Margaret Lindsay. And I thought really this might be a really nice and good opportunity to talk a little bit about the kind of legacies that this church has had for my life under the leadership of Chuck and Liz. So Danny's already mentioned a little bit that I kind of had a slightly crazy upbringing. I lived here for the first 26 years of my life. My parents came to the country in the early 70s, lived on kibbutz for a while, but then I think eventually moved away because they didn't want to entrust me as a newborn to a creche. I think my mom can correct me. And so most of my life here was kind of one of moving around lots. We moved probably on average every 2 or 3 years. We lived in Netanya, Tel Aviv, and latterly in Jerusalem. And I know for many of you, probably you don't recognize my face, but I did eventually come to Narcisse, probably around 1991, 92. And was immensely grateful to my parents in particular for allowing me to attend a church that they weren't regular members of at the time. They were attending Hebrew congregations, and so I'm grateful to them for releasing me into this wonderful place. And I can't obviously talk without mentioning the wonderful youth group that was evolving at the time. I don't know if many of you know, but the Narcisse youth group at the time was becoming the envy of believing circles in this country. It was gifted with incredible musical talents, powerful visions, and also quite a keen desire to radiate those influences more widely. And I was fortunate enough to attend along with Danny and other friends, also Liz in 1993. We went on mission trips to Russia and Slovakia, and kind of both formerly members of the Eastern Bloc, and just emerging really from regimes of oppression. And so for me, it was really interesting to hear Liz's talk last week. I knew a little bit about her history, but I think it kind of really drove home perhaps how important those trips were, especially to Slovakia, in terms of both renewing ties with family, but also bringing a message of freedom and hope to people who had, for so many years, lived under communist oppression. So those are really great memories, I think, of my time with the youth group. The mission trips, of course, were not only about sort of talking to people on the streets, it was also about cultivating links amongst ourselves, and of course, not everything was a bed of roses. We did have our border skirmishes, and thanks, of course, to sleep deprivation and, of course, throwing into the mix, teenage complexes and such. But I think really some of these ingredients, some of these aspects of the trip, even moments of crises, as anyone who's maybe been to boot camp will tell you, are kind of the best ingredients for building up long-term friendships, lifetime friendships. I also remember on the trip to Slovakia in particular, when all our travel money was stolen, and I was really, really struck at the time by Liz's equanimity. Liz was sort of in charge of the travel money, and incredible can-do attitude in the situation. And I also remember eating bananas, right? Bananas for the rest of our trip, thanks to a very loving regime of austerity. And so these are, you know, wonderful moments. And I can't believe that this is now going back 25 years ago. Incredible. So really, these are legacies and really formative years in my life. And I think really a testament to the kind of love, compassion, and grace that Liz certainly has, you know, shown here in her talk and has experienced under Bob and Margaret Lindsay. I think the long-term significance of these trips, as I've said, are kind of in terms of strengthening ties among the youth of Narkis. And also, I think some of the profound intellectual values that we've learned here at Narkis. One of the other wonderful aspects, it was the remarkable capacity, I think, even during youth group, for nurturing the intellectual as well as the emotional and spiritual faculties of its members. And although not incredibly inclined to intervene in debate or polemics myself, I was always really greatly intrigued and indeed quietly shaped, I think, by some of these heated discussions around politics and religion. I think the ability of sharp minds to critique and question accepted norms and truths, to advocate for the underdog, to coax people out of hardened positions, to encourage and respect dissenting views, to be all things to all women and men. And these were really beautiful incarnations, I think, of Christ's mind and ways with the Pharisees. The youth group legacies would, I think, sustain many of us in the years to come as we had to soldier on with the more routine aspects of life, including the testing final years of high school, for some of us, the army and university, or shorter stints outside of the country. On a personal level, and I know I'm not alone here, these formative years at Narkis, I think, have continued to sustain and nurture many lives, even over the course of many years away. Years that I think invariably begin with relentless pining for return, but also kind of slowly morph into a kind of acceptance, perhaps. The physical return may not be viable. I said it. It's good that these words are on paper, because if they weren't, I'd probably be in floods of tears at the moment. I wrestle daily with that loss, most perceptibly in dreams. And in waking, I think I've had to learn, in the interest of survival, to commute this sentence of seeming exile into a labor of empowerment in the here and now. Narkis, I think this intense place of local belonging has been a difficult one to find in other places. In 2002, nearly 16 years ago now, again, I keep thinking, oh my goodness, this is 10 more years and I will have been away more than I ever lived here. I moved to Manchester, England to marry my husband, Matt Jackson. Hello, Matt, if you're there. Who was then in the middle of his medical studies. And one of the things I've been so immensely grateful for in Matt is his shared experience of Narcisse. He himself spent 7 years here, at high school, at the Anglican school, and attended an evolved version of Narcisse Youth Group. He too has been fortunate enough to experience so many of these life-changing aspects of Narcisse. But there's also failures, really, to speak of in moving. And I confess to have failed, really, mostly in my search for church and community during my time in the UK. I've struggled, I think, with the often cliquey, I think these are kind of aspects that Danny touched about earlier, some of the formal and highly structured aspects of church, the love of hierarchies, the target-driven mentality, the idea that the measure of a church's success is in numbers, an elaborate spectacle, and clever rotas. My inbuilt, I think, protectiveness of the Sabbath, rest, and weekend unwinding has not helped matters either. The idea of church as just another place of work and toil sends me running. I do love the way a plan comes together at Narcisse often, rather effortlessly on a Sabbath here. It takes a while, but it happens, usually consisting of leftovers or Hillel Street lunch options, but above all, prioritizing fellowship and friendship. And you always know you belong if you're welcomed into a heated discussion. Okay, this is always the cherry on the cake. Manchester, UK, where I'm currently living, where our family of four live, has much to offer, although much of this can never replace that first or native love that I've been speaking of. The journalist and critic Stuart McKinney rather aptly writes that Manchester changed the world's politics, from vegetarianism to feminism, to trade unionism to communism. Every upstart notion that ever got ideas above its station, every snotty street fighter of a radical philosophy was fostered brawling in Manchester streets, mills, pubs, churches, and debating halls. Manchester really is truly the progenitor of radicalism. And if you ever come for a visit, I hope you do, you might run into two statues of Friedrich Engels, one of which is a climbable beard. You can see the library where Marx and Engels did research together for what would eventually become the Communist Manifesto. The house where one of Britain's leading suffragettes, Emmeline Pankhurst, lived. Important sites where trade unionism and Chartism were embroiled in arenas of class conflict. Chartism, for those of you who don't know, was a 19th century movement that fought for the working men's vote and also for parliamentary reform. You can also see Elizabeth Gaskell's house, a Victorian writer who is considered a leading pioneer of Victorian social problem fiction, in which 19th century slum life, poverty, and employment injustices were brought before a middle-class Victorian reading public. Visitors to Manchester might also be treated to a recent sprinkling of worker bee sculptures across town, not too dissimilar to the lion sculptures, perhaps, that adorned Jerusalem in the early noughties. The worker bee here being a symbol of Manchester industry, and the origins of the symbol are in the Industrial Revolution. And of course, it goes without saying, we have Manchester United, enough to convince any aspiring football radical to stomp by town. This is where I live now, and the radical strands of this place, many of which have led to extraordinary changes in the tides of oppression in some arenas, but also ones that have led to unspeakable forms of suffering in other areas of the globe. are there as histories to learn from and be shaped by. As Danny mentioned earlier, I've been studying hard over the last decade with a PhD in literature, recently completed at the University of Manchester. And in a nutshell, my research covers the work of late 19th century and early 20th century prolific novelist, poet, and writer of short fiction by the name of Thomas Hardy. A hugely popular and equally controversial writer who in literary criticism is often thought to be second only to Shakespeare. Hardy is often remembered for being a strongly local writer. His semi-fictional Wessex corresponds to regions in West Country England, including Dorset, Devon, Cornwall, Wiltshire, and Somerset. And yet, one of the distinctive aspects of his work is the sheer volume, I think, of departures to and returns from global spaces that occur right across his work. And this, I think, was an under-researched aspect within Hardy's studies, and something that gave me, I think, an idea for the kind of work that I might do at PhD level. And of course, I think many of the critical skills that are required for this kind of work were shaped by my years at Narcisse and the many stimulating debates here. I think even more remarkable about Hardy's work are the incredible insights he has and that he's able to bring to bear upon the migrant experiences in his work, ones that, as you can imagine, appeal hugely to one who has left a native home for another country. Hardy's work seems to profoundly realize what it is like to be inexorably shaped by the new places we arrive at, but also what it is like to be ever haunted by those native experiences. And I'll just give you three short examples from his fiction. In his short story, A Few Crusted Characters, someone by the name of Mr. Lackland, note the name, returns to his native Upper Longpuddle 35 years after emigrating to Newfoundland in Canada with his parents and sister. Note, I think, that wonderful irony presented in the contrast between the name Lackland and Newfoundland. Bereft of family and means, he explains to the locals when he returns that new countries are not full of promise. Even in new countries, there are failures. The race is not always to the swift, nor the battle to the strong. And perhaps this might resonate with some of you who have chosen to relocate and perhaps set up camp here in Israel, the hardships of making vision and reality coalesce. Incidentally, Mr. Lackland in Hardy's story realizes that he can never resettle into the local life he had once known prior to emigration. The tale ends with his ghost-like disappearance from Upper Longpuddle. In another short story by the title of Interlopers at the Knap, Philip Hull, the son of a deceased dairyman, returns from Australia with his wife Helena and two children, utterly destitute. He dies of poor health mere hours after his arrival on the English rural homestead. He explains to his widowed mother on his return that in Australia, things were against me and went from bad to worse. Another example of failed emigration. In the novel Jude the Obscure, published around 1895, little Father Time, born to English parents in Australia, arrives in England at the age of six with a ruthlessly inquiring mind and an unsettling ability to read people. He's described as one who is preternaturally old, age masquerading as juvenility. How many refugee children probably share in his experience of premature aging. And yet, in other aspects, Father Time is unable to read his surroundings, namely the English landscapes, To him, the houses, the willows, the obscure fields beyond were apparently regarded not as brick residences, pollards, meadows, but as human dwellings in the abstract, vegetation, and the wild, dark world. As a Middle Eastern desert baby, I've often struggled to learn the names of plants and flowers. There seems to be such a profusion of these in the UK, so I can relate to that. I've often wondered how an author who lived a relentlessly regional life, having traveled himself no further than Europe, and even then only on holidays, was able to offer such tragic insights into the migrant experience. Perhaps it was the discomfort that often accompanied his having to mix in high society when he himself hailed from the working classes. Of course, not many working class writers were able to garner the kind of acclaim that Hardy did. And the fame often came at a price, which was that he had to mix in circles he had no particular regard for. He often straddled the borders between London and his native Dorchester, the borders between wealth and poverty, and he must have known in his own way what it was like to be a stranger abroad. Or maybe this deep understanding of the migrant experience also had to do with Hardy's known rejection of popular jingoism and overweening pride in Britain's expanding empire, in which Britain came to rule over a quarter of the globe and a fifth of the world's population. If Hardy could portray the process of emigration to the colonies in a cold, hard light, he could perhaps challenge prevalent myths of colonial superiority, racial superiority that really were foundational to Britain's civilizing mission. Whatever the case may be, this deeply local writer turns out to have a vision of humanity that is astonishingly global in its reach. It is, in other words, a global vision. And I approach the end of my talk by reading a poem that he wrote in 1913, just before the outbreak of World War I, when European nations were soon to amass their armies in a battle for imperial supremacy, among other things. And the title of the poem is His Country. I journeyed from my native spot across the South Sea Shine, and found that people in Holland cot labored and suffered each his lot, even as I did mine. Thus noting them in meads and marts, it did not seem to me that my dear country with its hearts, minds, yearnings, worse and better parts, had ended with the sea. I further and further went anon, and such I still surveyed, and further yet, yea, on and on, and all the men I looked upon had heartstrings fellow made. I trace the whole terrestrial round, homing the other side. Then said I, what is there to bound my denizenship? It seems I have found its scope to be worldwide. I asked me, whom have I to fight, and whom have I to dare, and whom to weaken, crush, and blight? My country seems to have kept in sight on my way everywhere. My house shall be called a house of prayer for all nations, another rich expression of the kind of global reach that starts with microcosms of inclusion and belonging. In my father's house, there are many mansions. I go to prepare a place for you. I'm thankful that, unlike Hardy's returning emigrants, I always feel right at home when I return for visits to Jerusalem. I may invariably lose another piece of paper that stands as a marker of residency. So 2 or 3 years ago, it was my Israeli driver's license. This visit, it's been my tu dat zehut. But this stone structure and its beautiful people, old and new, remain rooted year on year. And I'm so thankful for this spot of heaven. Thanks.